Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast.
Today we have a special edition of yet another podcast, an extraordinary and amazing collection of people, some of the top authors for Pluralsight. We have K. Scott Allen, Joe Eames, Craig Shoemaker, John Papa, Julie Lerman, and Steve Smith. How are you all?
Fantastic.
Great.
Doing great.
That's what I wanted to hear. You're all here. It's good to have you here. Scott, they're using you in a most provocative advertisement for Pluralsight. Should we start there?
I think what Pluralsight wanted to do is just attract some more talent because it is working out very well, and it certainly is someone who has written books and done other activities before. It's much more rewarding, not just financially, actually, but in a number of ways. I think making videos is the way to go.
Yeah, I would agree with that in terms of reward, in terms of feedback, in terms of amount of effort for what you accomplish. It does seem to stand out. The only thing I find more rewarding is standing up in front of people so that I get that immediate feedback. But creating videos has been a blast.
Right. I've never gotten to the end of a book project where I've been entirely happy with the book. I've gotten through a number of Pluralsight courses where I've been pretty happy with the result, but books have always been very frustrating to me because of the constraints on the formats that you have to use, and I think it's very hard to show the evolution of actually walking through how to build an application in a book. It's just very tough. Whereas videos, I think, are a perfect way to describe some of the things that we actually have to do.
You know, and one of the things I think is really amazing is if you look at, you know, Scott had great timing and great content, and that combination is awesome combination of Pluralsight. But I think the real key is if you look at this year's top 10 or top 20 courses that are in Pluralsight, I believe 5 or 6 of the top 10 are courses that came out this year. So it's interesting to see the different topics and the different array of people coming out there. And I think the interesting thing about all the new authors is the course quality seems to be getting better. I even look at stuff that I did 2 years ago and the stuff I'm doing now, and I believe that the stuff I'm doing now is better than I was doing 2 years ago. And I think that's the same for most of the authors, too. I think that the competition's helped the quality level raise up.
And then every once in a while, you get people who come out of nowhere. Jeremy Clark, who unfortunately couldn't join us today, listed his new course on July 2nd. And as far as I can tell, it went straight to number 2 and has stayed there.
It's amazing.
Well, I can definitely speak to the fact that competition among authors and among myself has really helped improve the quality. Like the course that I'm doing right now is the second edition of my HTML5 fundamentals course. And I'll speak for myself. I mean, when I watch what I did a couple of years ago, I just cringe. And I'm so grateful for the fact that I have an opportunity to redo it and revisit some of that content.
Yeah, I've definitely looked at some of the courses, even by some of you here right now and recent years, and said, wow, I really need to step up what my courses have. So, you know, I agree that the quality bar is definitely going up.
And Steve, you're doing an interesting thing. Some of the courses that you do, like 2 of the courses that I did, are specifically for Telerik and targeted at Telerik clients, which is a whole other use of Pluralsight.
Yeah, I mean, at the moment, actually, none of mine are, but certainly a lot of the authors that I'm talking to are doing Telerik-specific courses. But the one I'm working on right this moment is a refactoring course, and then Julie and I are doing a domain-driven design course now-ish as well, as soon as I get this other one done.
A domain-driven design course is going to be a killer course.
We sure hope so.
John, what are you working on?
Right now I'm working on an adaptation of my SPA Jumpstart course, which is doing the same kind of thing but with Angular and tossing in a bunch of top requested features that I've gotten on SPA. And kind of the goal of this course is to show 2 really awesome frameworks side by side and how you can build the same thing. And it's not just you must pick your favorite because one's going to be better than the other. It's more of just pick the one that appeals more to you. In this case, Durandal or Angular.
All right. Well, all of you have to stop building these great courses. Craig, are you working on a new course now?
Well, I'll finish up this next course within the week or so. And then I haven't exactly decided what my next one's going to be after that.
And what about you, Joe?
I'm working on an Angular course for .NET developers.
That'll be one I want to see as a .NET developer. And Scott, are you still making courses?
Once in a while. I just finished up a course called Learning to Program. It's part 2 in a series. This one covers Python, which is just generally geared towards people that are relatively new to computer programming. And I try to give it a slightly different twist and teach people what I wish I would have been taught when I was picking up computer programming.
And are any of you working at this? Sounds great, Scott. It does, actually. Are any of you working at this full time, or is this a side thing for all of you, all of us?
I'm working at it full time right now.
That's Craig. Okay.
Yeah.
Not me. It's definitely just when I have time for it, or when I can make time for it. So it's definitely not full time.
Right. Same with me. I'm currently really only able to do about 2 courses a year. I'm hoping for 3 this year. So definitely just a weekends and evenings engagement for me.
Yeah, it's the same for me here. I work about 3 hours a day, 5 days a week on courses, usually somewhere between 10 p.m. and 1 a.m. That's about all I can find.
Oh, my God, I couldn't do it.
No, I couldn't do the nights. I do the weekends. I work on it on weekends, and I cheat and make my courses shorter, which is why there's a few of them rather than just one. But, Steve, you had one course that was, like, what, 160 hours or something?
Well, that's the design patterns course. So it has a number of authors, and I'm just listed first because I barely have a plurality of the percentage of time.
But it's like 15 courses that make up this. It's a series with a whole bunch of courses in it, right?
Right. Yeah. The design. That's the design pattern library, which anyone can jump in anywhere to learn about a particular design pattern. But I've only recorded like 6 or 8 of those design patterns, and there's like 30 or something in there. So.
And you guys are continually adding to that one, right?
Yeah, I added one this year, and I've got another one that's in the queue for me to add as well. Although at this point we've covered pretty much all the mainstays that are in the literature, so it's pretty complete at this point.
That's awesome.
And that's not a version 1, version 2, version 3 that gets outdated. That's just awesome because it's constant.
It's the design patterns.
And that design patterns library stays up pretty well in terms of popularity in the library. Although I guess with 150 hours. If it's counted as one big thing, that also has something to do with that too, I guess.
Yeah, that helps. Like right now it looks like it's number 8. And yeah, it does have a lot of space. I was surprised. I did a contest a few months ago to see how many people could finish courses of mine. And a number of people got the badge on their Telerik profile saying that they'd finished the design pattern library. So kudos to them. I mean, that's a lot of stuff to watch.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Do you guys watch the standings on Pluralsight.com, the leaderboard? And if so, how often?
Oh, when I have a course that's doing well, I watch it constantly to see if it gets into the top 10 or how quickly it falls out. But once I'm not anywhere even near that, I don't look anymore.
Same for me.
But it's exciting. And it's fun to watch other people's courses fly up there, too. It's really fun.
I was on vacation and not really paying attention right after my current course came out, the one on HTML5 offline applications and all that. And I had Julie telling me on Twitter that, you know, it's going up the charts. It's at number 5. It's at number 2 or whatever. And so that was neat to be able to kind of go along with someone and experience that together.
And it's a little bit like a sport, you know, because if you ever see a course pick up there and hit number 1, it's kind of like somebody beat the Lakers.
But, you know, it is funny. I hate for people to perceive any of it as being us being competitive with each other. And, you know, it's a funny thing, right? I mean, it really is fun to watch any course do that. It's really fun, but it's certainly extra fun when it's your own because, God, what a pat on the back that is.
Well, and I think that we all realize that, I'm sure that all authors realize that we benefit greatly because of the other great content in the course. Wouldn't be subscribers, there wouldn't be people watching. What makes this so amazing is all the fantastic content that's out there. I don't do well on my own. I do well because I'm in this fantastic library. My courses are in a great library. Nobody's going to pay to watch just my course, but they're going to pay to watch my course along with every other course that's in there, you know, thousands of hours of content.
Yeah, I think the leaderboard's pretty cool. I probably check it maybe once a month, but I definitely look at some of the internal reports we get to see like which of my courses are most popular and are they trending up or down in terms of like how many hours a month people are watching them?
No, for me, it's a lot more frequent than that.
I realize I haven't published any new courses since like the beginning of the year. So once I have this one done, I'll probably check a little more frequently.
Right.
So what's our advice to people who are listening and thinking, oh, I want in on this and how do I get started and how do I get my course up to do really well on Pluralsight?
Well, this is Steve Smith, and I think the most important thing is that they should talk to me so that I can get that referral bonus for that new author.
No,
what's that email address there, Steve?
All referrals will be going through my podcast and my website. Thank you very much.
When I started it up, I was kind of surprised that they wanted me to be an author, and they asked me to be, you know, send in a, they do a little test video with you. And so I kind of thought, oh, I don't have the skill set. But it turned out that with a little bit of coaching, you know, I get fairly decent feedback about my courses. So first off, I say would be getting over the hurdle of thinking that you aren't qualified or you aren't good enough to author a course. Because in reality, you know, people have things to benefit the community with, and authoring a course in Pluralsight is one of the best ways to do that.
And do you think authoring a course in Pluralsight brings the cachet that writing a book used to bring? Does it bring that kind of automatic expertise or assumption of expertise?
Absolutely.
I think it does for the microcosm of software developers. But I will say that my parents get a kick out of going into Borders or whatever bookstore that hasn't gone out of business yet and seeing like a book of mine on the shelf. And I guess
right,
today maybe
we're on their shelves. We can they proudly show it off to people who come to the house, even though they always say we have no idea what it's about.
Right.
Well, yeah, you've been talking to my mom too. I just want to welcome Michael Perry to the conversation. We had a little trouble adding him, but I believe he's here now. Are you, Michael?
I am here. Thank you, Jesse.
Excellent. Excellent to have you. We were just talking about advice to potential Pluralsight authors, and what we haven't gotten to yet is advice on what makes for a really good and successful course.
Can I add something real quick on, I'll kind of hit on both, and that is to not underestimate what kind of time commitment is required in order to make one of these courses. And I don't say this to deter anyone, but just to know that if you want to create a quality production, you know, it's just not something that you can do overnight. And by doing that, though, you end up with something that you're proud of and people want to learn. And so if you have that experience either speaking, or I started out sort of podcasting and doing some of those things, as long as you go in with the right expectations so you don't get frustrated that they're, you know, you're creating hours worth of training content, and it is a fair amount of work.
Yes, I agree. It is a good bit of work. I think each of us works in a different way. When I started, I used to record just the video and then over-record on top of that the audio and then do a pass to take out all of the empty space and then do a pass to add my call-outs and zooming. And so it was very, very time-consuming. Now, I've collapsed that with experience. I've collapsed that some. But I think it's very important to pay attention to all of those pieces, and they are time-consuming pieces. So a one-hour video can, or let's change that, a 10-minute video can take with prep time and making sure that you have the right example and that it's going to be smooth and redoing one in a few. You're looking at as, you know, anywhere from 30 to 60 minutes for a 10-minute video.
Wait, you can do 10 minutes off in 30 to 60 minutes?
Yeah, I see that's pretty
good.
Did
I say that?
Yeah, I mean, that's the funny thing, and people ask
all
the time.
Well, you have been rapidly releasing them.
I just keep my quality low, that's all, Julie.
No, that's not necessarily the reason the ratio would be low. I mean, look at John Sonmez, you know? He's, like, just cranking them out, and what he's doing is excellent. He's got, you know, excellent work. It's hard for me. I don't know if, you know, I think there are other people who take as long as I do, but I think a 40-minute module could take me anywhere from 20 to 40 hours. It's crazy, but that it just does, which is why I'm not releasing them frequently, and I take big breaks in between because it was so hard.
Yeah, for me, it takes about, I'd spend weekends and evenings. And yeah, it takes about 1 week for me to put together a 45 to an hour module.
Scott, I'm sorry, did you answer this? Are you full time at this, or is this part time?
Me, no, I can't do this full time. I really enjoy doing videos, but I find it to be such a draining effort that I have to get back to something normal, like working on a team doing software development for a period of time.
Yeah, well, so, it's easy to lose touch with that.
Yeah, what I've done as this has gotten better, is just try to arrange with clients and the company that I work with to block off time and say, I'm not going to be available during this week because I'm going to try to record something this week.
It's not just for Scott, maybe some of the others who crank it out differently. When you're setting aside that week, do you just 100% focus on that and you don't have any other distractions?
That's the plan. It rarely goes that way, but ideally that's what would happen.
See, now I could never work that way. I can't do video in, like, take a day off and do 8 hours of video. I can do a half day or a quarter of a day or an evening or break it up, but to sit there in a concentrated way and just do video after video for 8 hours, it would be beyond my concentration ability.
For me, recording the video is a fraction of the time. I mean, I spend a ton of time working on the slides. I try to come up with appropriate images that make it so that the student has something they can remember with an image to go along with whatever point I'm trying to make. And that's before we even get to, like, writing up code for samples and then figuring out how I want to present those samples and go through them. So the actual recording is maybe 20% of the total time.
And then there's the editing.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, well, when I start recording, I kind of get in the zone and the recording tends to go okay. Although I find that I can't put two thoughts together appropriately sometimes, where I just have to stop and restart all the time. But usually once I get into the flow of recording, things go well. And then editing is always just like, that's for me where it gets to be like, okay, this is, I'm working now.
Do folks do a module at a time? The way I work is I do a module at a time. That is to say, I do my research, I set up my slides, write my slides, get them the way I want them, then do the practice of the code, video the entire thing, edit the entire thing, produce the entire thing into the files, and as far as adding the questions to the question file and adding the meta file, and then that's one clip, and I'm on to this next clip. But I don't even do a module at a time. I do a clip at a time.
You mean a module, not a clip?
No, I mean a clip. I mean a 3-minute clip. It goes from conception to completion before I go to the next clip.
I do focus on a module at a time. I mean, I have the big picture that I know what I want to do for the whole course. Although sometimes that evolves, right? But I'll focus on a module and then, you know, I get some different ideas. So how things play out in the following modules might be a little different than I had anticipated. But, you know, I mean, that's always the way things work. But I focus on a complete module at a time. So, you know, one of those 30 to 40 to maybe 60 minute modules. And I create it and produce it. And then I move on to the next module.
Well, yeah, for my last course, I actually recorded things out of order, specifically so that things could evolve. That way I could record just the introduction last and make sure that it actually covered the actual outline that I was really presenting.
Yes, that's the one thing I do wait for, especially in my last course, because what I did was I kind of did a compilation of all the things I planned to do in the course. So I used I used visual aids from the subsequent videos. So yeah, the intro, and I do that when I'm writing too. Like all the books I've written, I've always written chapter one last, right? I'm sure the other book authors totally get that.
Absolutely.
You know, I think there's a combination of things that has to be taken into account when you're authoring a course. And one of them is the type of author you are. I mean, Julie and I are good friends, and we talk about the way we author courses, and it's a very different process, but it ends up with good quality either way, I like to think. But the other side is take the author out of it, and the kind of course you're creating tends to influence me, at least, on how I actually go and create the course. For example, if I'm doing a course on how do you do technology X, like TypeScript, I'm going to go through and I'm going to do each module one at a time, and I can pretty much start on that course from day one and take each topic and start writing my demos and slides and put out my content through recording, and I get that course out quicker. However, if I'm going to do a course like some of the Spot Jumpstart type things I've done, where it's end-to-end course, I first feel compelled to write the application that I'm going to be demonstrating from scratch, and then after I do that, I go back through it again, clean it all up, and then I go through it a third time and then decompose it into its original, how do I tell somebody how to build this now from scratch? And then I can start recording, which is the easy part. For that kind of a course, to me, you know, the vast majority, about 60 to 70% of the time, is in creating the content. Now, I don't know what's the right way to go or not the right way to go, but that's the kind of thing where if I tried to do that iteratively, it just doesn't work well. And I think what we're finding is that as courses are evolving and we're trying to create different kind of content, because everybody learns differently, the process of how you create it really needs to evolve with and line up with what you're trying to create.
Do you all watch the comments? Do you value the feedback? Do you respond to the comments?
Yes, sometimes and yes. Always.
Well done, John.
Ditto. Yeah.
I value most of the feedback. Occasionally, I get some feedback that's like, are you talking to me? But I always respond.
I crave the feedback. Of course, I crave good feedback, right? But I crave the feedback. I really do.
It's actually a lot of fun. It's really inviting to know that people actually watch our stuff, and it's very rewarding to hear the kind of questions they have, especially since some of them are things we probably didn't even think of, and it's really nice to hear back.
Well, it's good to be able to take that feedback and be able to maybe, like I updated a few of the clips in one of my courses based off of feedback that I got, because I wanted to make sure that question didn't keep coming up again and again for everybody else who watched it. Exactly. So it's definitely valuable.
So you added the clip in place, not an update to the course, but please replace this clip with this new replacement clip.
Yep.
Yep. I've done it too.
And what about technical editing? Do you have someone look at your work before you publish it? I recently did a course called HTML5 from scratch and didn't feel 100% on HTML5. So I actually hired a buddy to look at each clip and just tell me if I was leaving out anything crucial or saying anything stupid. And that was money out of my own pocket, but well spent, because a couple of things were in there that were just dopey and we caught them before they got published. What do you all do about technical quality?
I'll run stuff by people when I'm unsure of it. With my last course, the automated testing for fraidy cats like me, being a fraidy cat, I was afraid of missing stuff, concepts. So I had a couple of people review them in advance to make sure. But I also, and I'm sure like many people, I am crazy with making sure I've turned, information that I've looked at it from every point of view and asked people questions and really try to make sure that I have it technically correct.
Yeah, we're just practitioners. We're just people who have, gone out and used these techniques in our day-to-day jobs. And so as long as we can provide something that the audience finds valuable, we don't have to be the penultimate expert in that particular topic. We just have to be somebody who's willing to spend some time and put that content down. If we get something wrong, well, as Craig was saying, we can always go back and fix it. But, hopefully it's got some value to the audience, and that's really the best that we can do.
Scott had a really good point earlier. It wasn't the question he was asked, but he mentioned that, he doesn't do this full time, that he feels like he has to, I'm kind of rephrasing, that he has to do some development work in the meantime to kind of shake it up. And I think that's an important part of being a successful trainer in any field, is not only being a trainer, but also being somebody who does the actual work and has the experience. So I think having that combination of those two things, along with being able to be a good communicator, you put those three together, and I think you're going to have success in any kind of training, especially in Pluralsight. But if you're just a trainer or you're just somebody who does the work, sometimes that's not so easy. You look at somebody like Ted Williams, great baseball player, one of the best hitters or the best hitter ever. When he took his shot at the coaching side of things, it really didn't go so well for him. So I think it's important to have that mix up. And I'm kind of like Scott in that I like to do the work and train about it. I don't think I'd ever pick one or the other exclusively anymore.
I totally agree with that. And I also think that it comes down a lot to the research that you go through, right? You use a technology a lot and you feel like, okay, I'm going to talk about this technology. You still go through a phase of research where you're like planning out the course. You start thinking about all the things that you never thought to ask before.
Oh, yeah.
On a cover. And so there's a lot of research that goes in to make sure that you're more accurate than you would be if somebody just pulled you aside and said, hey, I know you've been doing this. Come and teach it to me. And on top of then there's a lot of different kinds of technical accuracy, right? Like there's some things that whether you say something is either yes or no correct. And then some things are best practices, things you learn by experience. And you want to give as much of that as possible to the audience. But those are things that somebody else might have a better idea. So over time, best practices can change. So some of those things, like Julie was saying, are kind of subjective.
At the risk of getting myself in big trouble, I'm going to confess that while I try to draw upon experience and whatever level of expertise, often I will teach a course or do a book or a conference on a topic that I want expertise in. And one of the best ways to achieve a really solid understanding of something is to teach it to someone else.
You know, I think for the kind of stuff that you've put out, Jesse, historically, and you've been extremely successful, probably more so than anybody I've ever met at that level of content, is when you're doing that, you're teaching yourself and you're also targeting an audience of people who are like-minded. So, for example, your JavaScript from scratch, you're looking at people who are looking to get into JavaScript and who haven't done that. You're not looking at the guy who's been doing JavaScript for 10 years and is an expert at it. And that field and that audience is very wide. So I think that works really well. The other side is, as you do that, of course, and as you're learning it, you've got to vet it and make sure you're absolutely right before you put it out there, which I know you do. But I don't think that's a bad tack to take. I think it depends upon the course you're trying to do and the audience you're trying to hit.
There's actually a poster in the martial arts dojo that I train in that says, to teach is to learn twice. And I've actually used that in one of my courses because it's definitely true. And I think that if you really want to learn something and really prove to yourself that you know it, you need to be able to teach it to somebody. So I do the same thing.
So if nobody minds, I have a question that I'd love to hear all your opinion on, and that's the future of online training. Where is this all heading? And I mean, things have changed so dramatically from most of us were like instructor-led training and traveling around classes for the last decade or so. This whole shift to online training away from books and in-person training seems really amazing to
me. Yes, I second that question. I think that one of the questions is, clearly Pluralsight has put together some magic, and it didn't happen overnight. They tried a lot of different formulas for how to put this together, and they have hit something really, really powerful. But is this a flash in the pan, or is this the beginning of an ongoing significant change in the way people are learning?
No, I think it's definitely the latter. I mean, look at something like Khan Academy and look at how many startups now are out there doing online college curriculum. For students, for people that want to learn stuff, the ability to find quality material for very, very reasonable cost compared to a traditional college tuition or in-person, you know, training like traditionally in our industry was done. It's amazing what you can get for your dollars now versus 10 years ago. And Khan Academy is completely changing how a lot of grade schools and high schools teach, where, you know, the lecture, instead of the teacher doing the lecture and, you know, the students doing their work at home, it's flipped. And the teachers might say, go watch this lecture. And then tomorrow we're going to work through the exercises in class. And the teacher is there to help and your peers are there to help. So I think it's fundamentally changing in places that have access to these resources, how people are learning today.
And I think it also has a lot to do with feature sets of the delivery mechanism, right? We have YouTube where we got tons and tons of content without any features. And so then you look at Khan Academy that has learning paths and those sorts of things, or Pluralsight, where you have curated content. You don't have to be subjected to content that isn't high quality. You've got learning paths, and Pluralsight's constantly coming up with features. They track what clips you watch. There's a few websites out there that I go to sometimes to look up videos on content, but they don't track which clips that I've watched. So if there's a lot of clips, I can't remember what I have seen, what I haven't. I don't remember when I've seen stuff. All those sorts of features, I can't watch those things on my mobile device. So it's all, especially offline, the feature set of these derivative learning centers are really advancing. And that's, I think, what's enabling education to move away from sitting inside of a classroom to sitting in front of a computer, not just because the content is there, but because the features sit around the content, delivering the right content at the right time to the right person with collaborating in a big group, like with Coursera's courses. Those are what makes all this possible.
And I think Pluralsight added one more factor to the equation, in that classroom training was one to few. And then we've got other online training courses, which are one to many. But Pluralsight really makes it a many-to-many model. So they're bringing the authors together. They're bringing the audience together. And so no matter what you want to teach, there's somebody out there who wants to learn it, and they're probably already a Pluralsight subscriber. And no matter what you want to learn, there's probably that topic already in the catalog.
Not only that, but I know I'm not the only one who does this, because I hear so many of you, of the Pluralsight authors, mentioning this in different forums, which is, when we're building our courses, I know when I'm building my courses, I'm always touching on other topics. And instead of having to dig into it, I can say, oh, go watch, you know, Steve Smith's pattern course on this, or go out, you know, like there's a Pluralsight course to fill this in. So I don't have to spend the time getting off track, making sure you understand this particular thing. And that's a huge benefit when we're doing the courses.
Yes, I find that the courses are a great supplement to presentations. And folks have come up to me after presentations and both said, oh, I watched your course and that helped me with your presentation. Or I'd like to get more information. I'm going to go to Pluralsight and look for the appropriate course to supplement.
I'm also seeing the same thing when I'm presenting, but I'm actually talking about the actual course. So I'll be building a course. And I'll touch on a topic and say, oh, you know, for more on that, go watch Scott Allen's course on repositories or whichever one.
Yep.
So like within the course, like you know, you're in a Pluralsight library, you're watching a Pluralsight course and it makes references to all these other Pluralsight courses. That's what I'm when was it Craig who was talking about many to many? That's Michael. What I'm thinking. It's like, you know, many authors. It's almost in a way, you know, for each subscriber, it's like many to one. Like they've got this broad expertise.
Well, I've even gone in during my last line of business course and said, okay, I'm getting into some content here. John Papa covers this in even greater detail in his course. And in fact, here's the module you want to look at in order to get further information on what I'm talking about.
That's great. So that kind of cross-fertilization gives the user the option to dive deeper or not.
Yeah, and I'm sure that over time we'll start to see some of those features baked into Pluralsight's platform as well. So we'll be able to say, here's related courses, here's prereq courses, here's where to go next after this course, and not necessarily have to do that while we're recording, but do it after the fact, and then that'll be exposed through the student's user interface. Those are all things that I know the Pluralsight team is working on. I just don't know when we'll have them.
Right. And in the meantime, what I've been doing, just to avoid the audio side of it, is I'll actually do like a call-out window. And Craig and I have shared our call-out techniques recently, and I appreciate that, Craig, to be able to put it in. Because it's a lot easier to put a little call-out, which is basically just a fly-up little window where I can put some text in to say, and by the way, if you want to learn more about this topic, go check out C# and Scott Allen's course or any framework in Julie Lerman's course, because I'm not going to dive into that topic for 5 hours right now.
So let me switch directions on you and do a little bit of behind-the-scenes exploration. When you're building your course, where are you sitting? What kind of equipment are you using? Are we all using the same screen capture software? What kind of microphone are you using? What's the actual physical process like for you?
As far as the physical process of recording, is that what you're referring to, Jesse?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I was one of those guys up front who was like, you know, I'm not so sure about this. I'm going to go cheap. I'm not going to listen to anybody's opinions. And I'm going to buy the cheapest microphone and headphones that I can have and go for it. And four microphones later, it lasted about 2 months. And four microphones later and about twice as much money as I could have spent if I just done it up front. I ended up buying a really good microphone that the Pluralsight team recommends, this Rode Podcaster that I think most of us use. And I actually got a nice little arm. It's like a little swiveling arm on my desk. And it fits on. It's nice. It's got a clamp that goes on any desk. And my total investment for the microphone and the arm was probably about $300 total. And then I've got a bunch of little side things that I use too. But it's one of those things where it makes a huge difference to get the good audio quality, to get the room set up, to do it right up front, as opposed to trying to do it on the cheap.
Let's take a little detail there. What are the side things and how do you set up your room to be right for this?
Well, there's some things you can't get away from, meaning you can buy audio softeners and whatnot to get through things. And Craig's got, you know, the perfect radio announcer voice and he's got the whole setup for it. And I envy that. But the one thing you can't get away from, no matter what kind of software you run things through, is if your room that you record in has bad acoustics, that's just, it's almost impossible to get rid of some of those kind of things. So I know some of the authors, not a lot of them, but some of them, like Dan Sullivan, actually has a sound recording room where he does things like hanging up sheets around the audio area that it records to soften the bounce off the walls and get rid of the echoes. Other things you can do, like I found a really cheap trick where I actually put two mouse pads underneath my keyboard. So when I'm typing, it's actually softened the sound of the keys typing as opposed to typing on the heart of the desk.
And Craig, you have a couple tips too. That's a great tip on the mouse pads. Thank you.
And Craig, you have a couple tips that you've been sharing that I've tried some and used and some I haven't, but you could probably elaborate more.
Yeah, well, I just had an interesting experience. We took our vacation and I brought my microphone with me thinking that I may need to record some fixes or something for my last course that went out. And when I came home, my whole sound environment completely changed. And I have a buddy who's a professional musician, and we were trying to figure out what was going on. I never got to the bottom of it. So I just recently changed my microphone because I had some that I'd been using throughout my podcast. And one of the things that I found that before I was using a large diaphragm, sort of, you know, really cool broadcast looking type of microphone that was omnidirectional. So I was just getting sound bouncing off the walls. And really right now I'm talking to you in a way that a sound person wouldn't want me to do because I'm facing the corner of my room. But by switching to a unidirectional microphone, now the sound that's going into the mic is really just the stuff that's coming in from where it's pointing. And that made a huge difference for me and also changed a lot of not having to do as much processing on the audio track in order to clean it up and make it sound as good as I want it to. So there's a lot of stuff as far as hardware is concerned, and then there's other things that you can do regarding software, and all of it, I think, really has its place in order to give it the best quality as possible.
Yeah, another easy thing to do, too, is to keep your audio level moving. So you want to have the same level as your center as you're talking like this, but you don't want to be doing something like this and then tail off at the end of your conversation. And some people talk like that. I do it sometimes. Sometimes at the end of my sentence, I kind of do this.
Well, and that's why it's a good idea to maybe look on YouTube and just spend a little bit of time watching and listening to the people who teach voice acting. And I'm not doing cartoon character voices or anything like that in my videos, but if you can get the mindset and you also have the understanding that, yes, people are looking at a screen and they can see the code window and they can see the browser, whatever you're doing, but for the most part, the way they're interacting with you is through your voice. And so being able to have somewhat of fluctuation, but without trailing off and doing all those things and making it interesting through your voice, that's also something that comes out in the production.
I'll give us a character now.
Yeah, like does somebody do that in real sign cartoon voices?
No, I'm saying that I don't think anyone does, but I'm just saying by listening to the advice that voice actors gives about how to keep your energy up, how to maintain a constant level to your voice, breathing a certain way. Now, I don't spend a lot of time thinking about that, but it just kind of goes back to what John said about Toastmasters. Any experience that you have in presenting kind of emerges as you're building your courses.
And a couple tips that I've used a lot recently is, it sounds weird, but I'll keep a glass of water near me. I'll keep a thing of chapstick or lip balm so my lips don't have the smacking while I'm talking. And then the other thing, which I found the most useful, is I put a little mirror right in front of my monitors as I'm recording so I can see my face. And the reason I do that is I find when I'm smiling while I record, my voice is much more engaging. But when I'm not, if I've just kind of stone cold face look, you know, because nobody can see me when I'm recording. If I do that, my voice is kind of
Yes, we can.
So,
when I record, I always have pictures of John Papa up in front of me, too. So I've found that helps.
I think it's time for me to change my address.
Steve, you were trying to get away.
But is it a signed photograph? That's what we need to know.
Not yet.
I'm losing control. Steve, you were trying to get a word in on some of these tips?
Sure. So the mirror thing is an excellent idea. I just wrote that down. Like call centers do that kind of thing because people really can't hear on the other end of the line whether or not somebody's smiling even just on a phone call. But in terms of setting up for recording, similar to what John Papa said about the mouse pads under the keyboard, I do the same thing with the foam that ships when you buy a computer, you know, the soft styrofoam. I put that under the keyboard, under the anything else that might make sound. I've had to switch out chairs that I use to record from if they have a squeak. Like every time I lean back, if the chair is going to squeak, that got annoying to edit out, so I got a different chair. And then the mouse, the clicking of the mouse to go from slide to slide or from bullet point to bullet point also tends to get annoying in the audio track. So a simple trick that I discovered is that, you know, in addition to using your keyboard, you can also use the mouse wheel. And, you know, the keyboard you still might hear, but the mouse wheel is almost completely silent. So I found that's a good tip to silently advance through your presentation.
I use that actually for advancing slides, although sometimes I'll turn it a little too far.
I started using a wireless presenter and like you'd use on stage, and I hold it underneath the desk so that my mic won't pick it up, and that tends to work really well.
Well, I have a weird way of recording, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that somebody was saying before, you know, you can't put two thoughts together. Well, I can't put two words together when I'm actually trying to record. And I've Sometimes I'll do it, but most of the time now I actually have to write down what I'm going to say, and I actually record it separately from the video, and then I edit them together afterwards. So when I'm recording the audio, I'm not even trying to read over the videos to line it up. I have nothing on the screen. Like, I'm not watching the video and I'm just doing the audio. And what I do is I finally graduated to one of those arms. I got the cheap desk stand. I have the Rode Podcaster and I have the, what is that stabilizer thing? I call it a neck.
Shock mount.
Yeah, I have a shock mount, but I had it on the desk and that was so limiting. So I finally gave in and I was so happy when I did it. I bought one of those big arms that John was talking about that you clamp to the desk. And it looks like a big recording studio now. But then when I'm recording, I'm standing when I'm doing my audio. I'm standing up and it's so much more natural for me and I'm flailing my arms around and it's just like I'm having a conversation with somebody. And that makes it sound pretty natural. I mean, that's my natural way of speaking when I'm standing and waving my arms about.
You should do some picture-in-picture of that, Julie. That would be very cool.
You know, I think what happens a lot of times when we record these videos, and I've had to re-record a few, I've done my own when I've caught myself doing this, is people are more interested in watching and listening to you when you're being more natural and you're being yourself and letting your personality come out. And sometimes when we do these recordings, I think we bottle those things up because we think they're not appropriate. But if you think about the keynotes and these sessions and the training that you've ever enjoyed in your life in any field, it's when somebody is not only teaching, but they're entertaining you in some way and keeping your interest. So I think it's important to remember to keep your personality in whatever you're recording. If you're a funny person, be funny. If you're not funny, don't try to be.
And watch John Papa's Pluralsight course on public speaking, which has some tremendous tips in it. And public speaking applies. Yes, we agree that public speaking applies to what we're doing with Pluralsight?
Yes,
absolutely.
I have one more.
You had mentioned the Toastmasters, but also speaking at user groups is a really great way to get into this and be more effective at speaking, especially about technical content.
Well, one of the things that I forgot to bring up when you're asking about technical review, often I'll take content that I'm working on to present it at a user group before I record it as a course. And that's great for getting some of those questions asked up front. And you can tell, like, the thing that I miss when I'm recording a course is when you look out on your audience when you're speaking in person, you know that look when you see it, and people just are lost or the dots aren't connecting. And so you have to backtrack and explain something in a different way. And then when that light bulb goes on, you know you've nailed it. And so that can definitely help you figure out a way to organize your thoughts and set up the way you're going to communicate this content effectively.
Yes, Steve and I are actually planning to do that with our domain-driven design course, because he's going to be, we're actually going to work together. He's coming here so that we can work together. And then later I'm going to go there so we can record together. So we're not going to just do, you know, okay, you do these modules and I'll do those modules. We're going to really do it together. So when he comes here, we're going to actually speak at my user group to just kind of work some of this, you know, work out our jokes, just to work some of the ideas out.
Yeah, my last course was actually just a collection of workshops that I'd prepared for the user group that I run locally. And, you know, after I'd done, you know, two or three of these workshops, I realized, hey, there's enough material here for a course. Yeah, I should go ahead and do that.
Let me bring this to a close by asking each of you, what's next in the immediate future for you? Are you going to be building new courses? Do you foresee this continuing for yourself indefinitely? Or what's your path?
Yeah, I'm definitely going to be building new courses. I like the idea that Pluralsight kind of gives the long tail a chance to shine. And I've got some concepts that I really want to explore that are not, you know, right there, you know, in the middle of the bell curve, like you know, C-sharp fundamentals, but you know, out at the boundaries. And so I'd love to make some courses that maybe not a lot of people are going to watch, but will really help me to express the way that that I think software should be developed and kind of you know, explore those areas.
Scott, what's the future hold for you?
Well, in the immediate future, we're going to try something different, which is actually getting together with Aris Clausen to try to do a course together in person. Yeah, so going back to what a couple other people had talked about, what Julie and Steve were going to do, not just divvy up a topic and work on different modules, but actually make a concerted effort to do a joint presentation.
I do want to thank you all. We had K. Scott Allen and Joe Eames and Craig Shoemaker, Michael Perry, John Papa, Julie Lerman, and Steve Smith. And I will put a short bio of each of you onto the page for this show. And if you have any links that you'd like me to attach to that, please let me know. We'll definitely do that. And I think this was terrific. I can't thank you enough.